From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, some ethical issues for reporters to consider when covering stories like the Waukesha stabbing. Later, the challenges of being an environmental clergyman.
You have people in your congregation on both sides of issues, and usually radically on both sides of issues, and they're all God's children. You got to walk with them all.
What a Milwaukee bookseller gets out of a huge New York book expo.
We're trying to figure out what people are talking about. And specifically to Milwaukee, we're pitching Milwaukee and the bookstore as a place for, say, authors to visit over the next year.
And we'll take a virtual tour of some of hidden Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The shocking stabbing of a 12-year-old girl in Waukesha by two of her friends has attracted media attention from around the world. That attention has been largely focused on writings and a character on a horror fiction website. The names of the accused girls have been all over the news as they stand charged in adult court for attempted murder. Meanwhile, the story of the mass shooting in Santa Barbara, California, has raised concerns by some about the level of attention given to the murderer, who left a lengthy manifesto offering his rationale for the depraved act he was about to commit. Both cases have sparked ethical discussions among reporters and editors, and also by people who head and read news stories. Kelly McBride is senior faculty in ethics at the Poynter Institute, a media training center and think tank in Florida. She joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich by phone and talked about what she believes are the ethical considerations the media ought to take into account as it sets about covering these stories.
Well, I think they have to consider what the journalistic purpose of telling the story in the first place is. And there are some very good ones. You obviously want to document what happened. You want to inform the public. You want to educate the public on the chances that you might be able to prevent further violence. You want to hold powerful organizations and people accountable. You know, does your police system and your justice system work? You want to scrutinize other systems like the mental health system or the healthcare system. So there are many, many good journalistic purposes behind the coverage of violent events. As a journalist, you want to figure out which purpose you're trying to serve and then really get to the heart of that particular purpose. And it will change from day to day and story to story, but it's very important to keep your goals in mind as you're making decisions about how close to get and when to name names and what photos to use and how emotionally wrenching the interviews should be.
Well, and you mentioned naming names. Here in Wisconsin, where we've just had this stabbing by two 12-year-old girls, many in the local media were quick to name the 12-year-old defendants in the stabbing, the rationale being it was because they were charged in adult court and because the crime was seen as so serious. Does that decision have any ethical ramifications in itself? Does that become one of these cases where the media has, in a way, already tried these girls simply by naming them?
Not necessarily. It is a pretty well-established tradition in mainstream media that you don't name juvenile criminals, and the exception being when a juvenile is charged as an adult because the crime is deemed so heinous. In that case, the journalists are deferring to another system within society, the prosecutor, and if the prosecutor feels like the evidence suggests that these children should be tried as an adult, I think it makes sense for the media not to second-guess that decision, but to treat that individual the way you would treat an adult criminal, which seems really harsh, even as I say it coming out of my mouth. It seems harsh. But, you can't make these decisions in a vacuum. You have to let the other systems of justice and ethics and social responsibility inform them, and we have this other system in place. And so if a prosecutor has said, for whatever reason, these children should be tried as an adult or as adults, then I think it's perfectly reasonable for the media to allow that to inform their decision.
What do you make of the argument that's getting a lot of attention lately, especially in light of the killings in Santa Barbara, that many of these tragic, depraved acts are calls for attention, and the more attention they draw, the more people think of media attention as a desired outcome for what they're considering, the feedback loop, if you will?
So I understand why people make that argument, and yet I think when you look at the complex mental situations that most of the perpetrators of these horrendous crimes are in, you can't oversimplify it to a simple call for attention and suggest that if we just didn't name them and give attention to these crimes, then nobody else would do that. There's not a one-to-one correlation there. That said, I think we need to be careful about doing two things. One is making sure that we also name the victims, that we say their names out loud, and that we tell their stories, and we make sure that people understand the value of their lives. And then, secondly, I think we need to avoid being gratuitous in naming a perpetrator. You don't want to maybe use his name in headlines. You certainly don't want to trivialize or allow his name to become a synonymous nickname for the crime. So there are things that we can do that will minimize the notoriety that this person achieves. But I think that the overwhelming good of informing the public and giving people the information they need to understand what happened outweighs the remote possibility that somebody else will commit a similar crime in order to gain the same type of attention. So I would never advocate not naming a perpetrator completely. I think that then the crime itself would take on a whole different sort of power, you know, like, I mean, the way like Voldemort does in Harry Potter. You know, if you can't say the name, it gives the person all sorts of creepy assigned power.
At the same time, people have pointed out that, you know, so many years later, everybody knows Jeffrey Dahmer's name, and almost nobody can name any of his victims.
That's absolutely true. And we haven't seen any Jeffrey Dahmer copycats.
In recent weeks, many media outlets printed or aired the sort of manifesto that the killer in California offered as he was apparently about to do his mass shooting. And of course, here in Wisconsin, the media jumped on the bizarre and horrifying details of what led to the stabbing by the 12-year-old girls. Is there an ethical way to use those kinds of details?
Absolutely. By adding as much context from experts as you possibly can. I was really hoping that someone would annotate the manifesto from Santa Barbara so that you could have a psychologist or a psychiatrist making comments saying, you know, this is an example of delusional behavior. This is a sociopathic tendency where he blames others for his misery, refusing to take any responsibility himself. The more context that you can add to that information, the more you allow the public that consumes it to see it for what it is, rather than being forced to say, well, yeah, that sounds reasonable, or I kind of get it. You give them the information they need to judge the very particular details in their appropriate context.
Do media outlets need to keep their eyes on what other media outlets are doing as the coverage progresses? I mean, none of these stories happen in a vacuum either. And so the issue of proportion in coverage becomes one where, you know, frankly, stories get overwhelming very quickly.
Yes, although that's a very hard conundrum to address, because If I'm the editor of a media outlet, do I not cover a story because my competitors are going gangbusters on it? That takes me out of the equation in the conversation, and will have all my audience turning to them. The reality is the media are, for the most part, in a competitive environment, and you see a fair amount of escalation with sensational stories like this. I think rather than try and account for your competitors' volume, what we need to do at media outlets is to determine what our audience needs and then to give them that information and to make sure that we are advancing the conversation and contributing new knowledge to the marketplace of ideas rather than just trying to match our competitors step for step.
Well, hopefully that's exactly what we have just done now. Kelly McBride, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Kelly McBride is senior faculty in ethics at the Poynter Institute, a media training center and think tank in Florida. She spoke with LegFX's Mitch Teich. Coming up next, why some local clergy have stepped up to demand significant reductions in carbon pollution. We'll have that conversation when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this week, the EPA released its long-anticipated Clean Power Plan. Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy describes it as achievable state-by-state goals to cut carbon emissions from coal-burning power plants. Wisconsin would be required to reduce its levels by more than 30% by 2030. Since the report's release, support and criticism have flooded air, newsprint, and social media. A group of faith-based leaders throughout the Midwest decided to speak out earlier and with one voice. Nearly 400 individuals representing multiple denominations co-signed letters to President Obama and the EPA. Jeff Barrow was among the signatories of the May 27th communication calling for swift action to reduce carbon pollution. Barrow is bishop to the Milwaukee Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz met Barrow at his office, which is just south of the Menominee Valley on Layton Boulevard. He explains why he not only signed the letter, but agreed to speak out through a press teleconference coordinated by an environmental group called Clean Wisconsin.
I was invited to do that. It's been a topic that traditionally has been very important in the life of the church and the world. And so if you think about it, you go back even to Bible camp. Our Bible camps that were often the leadership development for us, those were at the kind of groundbreaking level of looking at the environment through different eyes. And unfortunately, the environment has not been a very big topic of late politically. You get up onto Capitol Hill and you realize that there's great silence about environmental issues today. And you wish that there would be some kind of honest dialogue about a topic that affects everybody, no matter what your political persuasion is. I've always said that the most unfortunate thing about Al Gore is not what he was thinking or studying, but that he was a Democrat doing that. And so all of a sudden, for the first time, what should be a human issue becomes a political football. And that's really sad, because the people in Tanzania talk about climate change matter-of-factly, and they see it every day. And they can see that the snows on Kilimanjaro aren't what they used to be, and they feel the mosquitoes that come farther and farther up the mountains and affect more and more people. They see the change in their ability to produce food, and so Tanzania has experienced drought for 3 years in a row in a way that they've never done before. And it's unfortunate that people living close to land can see that so clearly. And for us, in this sophisticated environment of ours, it's such a subject of debate. And so I think the sad thing is that it's just not environmental issues just aren't getting the traction that they need to have, because it's in all of our interests. I don't care who you are, that we preserve the environment.
So Clean Wisconsin, the organization, asked you and others, mm-hmm. other church leaders, to come together to sign a letter.
Yeah.
What was the heart of the message of that letter?
Well, it's just that the carbon emissions are changing things.
Does your synod, does the church, is it at a point of saying, okay, let's mobilize our congregations and let's make ours a voice for awareness and movement on combating or adapting for climate change, for instance?
Traditionally, it's had that wonderful role, and it still needs to have that role. What's changed about churches, it's harder to speak on behalf of the church today in a divided political climate. Because if people don't like what the church is saying, they go find a different one. I think of my grandfather, who was probably mad at his church for the last 20 years of his life, would never think of changing. I mean, that was his church. That was, you know, with all its warts. I think it's more difficult today to speak into a charged political environment that is so polarized, because you have people in your congregations on both sides of issues, and usually radically on both sides of issues, and they're all God's children. You got to walk with them all. But it makes it more difficult, I think, to offer a universal word of challenge and expect everybody to say, oh, thank you for that word of counsel. So,
how did the churches in your synod or its leaders react to your signing on that letter?
I think, and that's why I don't sign letters as readily as I used to, because I think people want to be able to own the statements of the church that are made. And so sometimes you have to pause and say, let's talk about this before we just make a statement like that. In terms of the issue itself, it's a no-brainer for me. I mean, the care of the environment is a biblical principle that is not going away. It's how we interpret that that's I think the question now. And so if people don't want to hear things, they don't want to hear things.
It really does boil down to that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it does, and I think if you go back to the whole notion of what it means to be caretakers rather than subduers of the creation, that's an important step for people to make, and that as I go back to those texts in Genesis, in the early part of Genesis, they don't call us to manipulate the environment. That whole marvelous creation story is really one where we're called to be caretakers. Well, that doesn't mean that you exploit for whatever gain you can have out of it for the moment. It means that you look down the road and see what's left for the children. Well, you know, what's not to love about that?
Here, I mean, we're quite close to the Menominee Valley and to the power mm-hmm. plant that's, you know, part of the target for change. There's been lots and lots of discussion and talk of health impacts right here. Yeah. And there are those who say those health issues have nothing to do with that power plant.
It's like saying smoking has no impact on your lungs. Doesn't matter if you have filtered cigarettes or ultralight cigarettes, you're still exposing yourself. That's my reaction to that.
You talked about needing to be careful in what you sign and how you present issues. Would that be a fair way to assess it?
Yeah, and not just to appease everybody. I think there is a prophetic word to be said. But you also have to begin where people are and begin to help them open up issues that finally make sense and become transformative for themselves. The day has passed when when the church could just issue an edict and everybody says, "Oh, thank you, now I'm going to change." I think it's more difficult than that. We have to go back and revisit the biblical text. We have to talk about what it means to care for creation, to care for children, and let people kind of see the implications of that for themselves. And usually we don't until something close to home awakens our sensibilities. Well,
you're talking about some kind of a climate-related or spill or a...
Yeah, like where was it, up by Jackson, where what happened last year? The water got contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then all of a sudden everybody realized the environment is their issue. It affects them personally. Mm-hmm. And so you hope we can be a little more proactive in saying, you know, there are things happening all the time that are affecting our environment, but they don't cause an explosion. There isn't rapid contamination of the water, but it's eating away at the way we live. And if you think about it, what makes Wisconsin unique traditionally more than its marvelous, landscape and recreational possibilities and habitats that it's provided for all kinds of animals and birds and even people. Well, if we mess with that, just to get a quick buck, that concerns me as a human being and as a Christian for sure, because I don't think that's the way God intended us to live.
I know that we're sort of dancing around this carefully, but did you think long and hard about whether you should not only sign the letter, but there was a teleconference which you participated in?
Yeah.
Were those tough decisions to make?
No. To me, that's not a difficult issue to say I want to be a part of that. Most issues have some give and take to them, but I think there's an urgency about the environment.
Well, that's what I thought earlier when you said we can't issue an edict and expect people to follow what you might think is best for the world. Yeah. On the other hand, you've just mentioned you feel a sense of urgency. So how do you balance that?
Well, you have to just keep the issue up there. And for many people, it's a matter of inviting them into the discussion because, as I said, it's not in vogue to talk about the environment suddenly. That doesn't mean it's not an urgent issue. I did just hear from the bishop in Alaska, and she talks, again, matter-of-factly about how the native people out there, to go fishing, they don't have to go as far out anymore because the ice is shrinking. And we need to listen to folks who have lived next to the land for thousands of years in the same way. And when they say it's changing, it's probably changing. It's not just, that's today's news. So I think it's important that we pay attention again to what's happening in the world around us. There is a thing in my faith story that says, you know, in the end, God will take care of us all. I just think, and that certainly in the story of Christianity, there's this thought that the world won't go on forever. But goodness gracious, that doesn't mean we should waste what we have or exploit what we have, because we're still called to be caretakers of the creation.
Jeff Barrow is bishop to the Milwaukee Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Pence. Well, now that it's June, many of us are compiling our summer reading lists. Boswell Books' Daniel Golden joins us next with some suggestions. We'll have more of Lake Effect right after this on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Great to have you with us. Many readers are already stockpiling titles for their summer reading lists. It's a busy season for booksellers. Daniel Golden says it'll be a busy year ahead, in fact. The owner of Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company is back from the biggest book trade show of the year, and he joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke to share the titles he believes we'll all be hearing a lot about in the months to come. He also talked about the significance of the New York event to people in places like Milwaukee.
Well, this is a long-storied convention. This is actually the 29th time I've been there. It used to be called the American Booksellers Association Convention when the booksellers ran it. Probably 20 years ago, they sold it off to Reed, and it is now called the private part is called Book Expo. And it is the major convention of the United States, not of the world. There's a big one in Frankfurt and a big one in London. They are media launches. They are rights fairs. But there's also a component of booksellers, the traditional booksellers, the chain booksellers, the online booksellers, trying to make deals and figure out what's going to be hot and pretty much sort of set the tone for the rest of the year. This year, they have launched BookCon, which is a consumer function. Last year, I think they called it Consumer Day, but it was very, very limited to by invitation only. This year, I think they opened 10,000 slots. Not 10,000 slots. Could it be 10,000 people? I guess it could be 10,000 people. That sounds like a lot of people. And you know something? There were a lot of people on the floor. I do know it must have been 10,000 because I think they had over 2,000 people to see John Green, and it wasn't enough. They didn't have enough space. And so we expect this to expand next year. And so I guess people should mark their calendars now because it's a hot ticket.
But from the standpoint of a bookseller in Milwaukee, you come out of it with some sense for what you think is really going to fit with the people who buy books here.
Absolutely. We're doing all sorts of things. So on one level, we're trying to figure out what people are talking about. And specifically to Milwaukee, we're pitching Milwaukee and the bookstore as a place for, say, authors to visit over the next year. And so we do that. It's an opportunity to meet with publishers sometimes on the floor, sometimes at their offices, and often just accidentally. You'll have just these amazing conversations at a cocktail party, at a luncheon that you get invited to, or maybe just in the hall you'll introduce. I found myself connecting authors with people from even from public radio. There were some national public radio people there. And there were all sorts of crazy things going on.
Well, so let's talk about some of the titles that stick with you after leaving this conference. The one that everyone was talking about, not just you, really is getting buzz from all over, something from David Mitchell.
Oh, absolutely. And perhaps this is the first new release after Cloud Atlas was a film. So I think there was a lot of resonance. The Bone Clocks is the book. It is about a young girl with mystic powers who sort of runs away from home and becomes the target of two competing sects. Something terrible happens and it follows her. It's David Mitchell. And so it's not a thriller. It's not a supernatural thriller. It's definitely a meta book. And people are describing it as the most Mitchell-esque book ever. So it will forever define what a David Mitchell book is.
And you say it's not a thriller. This is not another version of the Danielle Trissoni trilogy with angels
That's
chasing
right.
each other.
He's always writing about lots of different things. And even his historical books become, you know, there's a speculative element. There's always a lot of philosophy built into his books. Structurally, he's interesting. He's a language writer. So the books tend to be very dense. But, you know, so it's fascinating for us because to us, we think of him as an intensely literary writer, multiple times nominated for the Man Booker Prize. And there is this huge poster as you come in. Only about five books had it. You know, it was incredibly expensive. It was definitely the galley everyone was talking about. There's a lot of signings that people have. The signing component has exploded over the past 10 years. When I first started going there, you were not allowed to sign on the floor. In fact, Kay Gibbons, we surreptitiously tried to get some books signed from her, and the guards chased me and my fellow bookseller and we were like chasing with Kay Gibbons over the floor, getting away, escaping into so that we could get our books signed. That's not the case anymore. There's lines everywhere. And sometimes, you know, it's structurally, you're just like, it's a maze. I think the David Mitchell just like wove halfway through the show floor. And it's an enormous floor.
Well, and I'll name drop. While it was going on, I'm friends with Karen Abbott, who has a book coming out down the road.
Sure.
And she posted a picture of herself after she realized she was signing books next to Alan Cummings.
Oh, my gosh. That's the thing is, like, I don't tend – you know, we do a lot of events. I don't need to be in these lines. I don't need to take up all my time. But I have this thing what I call the pity lineup, which is when I see – a book that I like or that I'm interested in, and I'm always looking for books for various people to get. When I know the publicist, when I – you know, there was one line, John Scalzi. It wasn't a very long line, and my buyer Jason is a huge fan of John Scalzi. And I said, oh, it's across from the Bloomsbury sign. I'll make a pitch for Jessamyn Forge at the same time because I know the publicist there. And, you know, so you kind of play it out. Like Lauren Bukes, who is the South African writer who – she sort of broke out with Shining Girls. It wasn't her first book by any means. She was signing for her next book, and it was a pretty good line. So I just went through over and over again. You know, guess like, oh, I can think of another person for this book.
So if everyone was talking about The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell, what was the book that you were most talking about coming out of this conference?
Well, I do tend to want to have a mission when I go there. I have a number of missions, but one of mine is must help a book, must find some weird book or booth. Like sometimes I'll find like a really great booth and it's something to like start the conversation with. And sometimes it's an adult book that I've read. I did go into the show having read I'm like pro Wisconsin. So and everybody pretends like you'll see these books set in Wisconsin and you'll read the copy and Wisconsin will not be mentioned. So I'm always going in trying to tell them that a book that they might think is regional is not regional. And so I had one book called My Family and Other Hazards by June Melby, which is set at a golf course in Waupaca. It's a great memoir. It's structured really well. It reminded me of Daniel Trussoni in that it's three narratives going on at the same time.
This is Daniel Trussoni's memoir.
Memoir from a long time ago. Yeah, not
Angel Ossoff.
Not Angel stuff. And it's funny, it's smart, and it's and so I was telling NPR, I was telling the editor at Amazon, who does the newsletter, about it. I mean, I have no pride. I'm going to sell this book. And so that was that. And then on the kids' side, I just found this amazing book. I was so excited about it. It's called Before After, and I can't pronounce the author's name that well. It's Matthias Aregui, and it's wordless, which is very hot. Picture books are – there's so many wordless picture books, and some of the most amazing books are wordless nowadays. It's also completely an adult crossover. It's thick. It's beautifully – it's one of those beautiful graphic – perfect graphic books. And so you have these two-page spreads, and it's before and after. And sometimes it's a four-page spread, two pages of before, two pages after. So for example, a classic one would be coffee beans, coffee. And then you would see candle, candle burned out. But then maybe on the next page you'd see candle, light bulb, or passenger pigeon, quill pen in an inkwell. You'd see quill pen in an inkwell, typewriter. That it's beautiful, it's smart, you can see kids thinking about it, and there's all these little details, and nobody had known about it. That was the cool thing. Because a lot of times you tell people out, it's like, yeah, I've been. Because the buyers have all bought already. One of the tricks, the business is speeding up, and everybody's asking us to buy earlier and earlier. Not for us, the independent bookstores, but for the national accounts. And so the buyers are getting bored. Our buyer, Jason, came back and said, I know everything already. I don't know what the point of the show is, but it's to discover this book that then you're like – so I started sending all these people to the Candlewick booth saying, you got to see this book. And because it's going to be one of those books that's going to be impossible to reprint. It's, you know, very hard. It's full color. The presses – they don't do presses in the United States with full color. Just beautiful.
So that's Before After, Matthias Aregui. There is another children's book or another picture book that that you're pretty high on and you're thrilled to already be able to book.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's the thing is we don't – you know, I talk to the big cities in Boston and New York and Washington, and they're completely booked up for fall already. And we're always – you know, we're a second-tier market. We're competing with St. Louis and Cincinnati and Kansas City and Cleveland and, you know, for events and Wichita. And So we get booked later. They like see how things are going. They fill in the holes. They find out that somebody has a connection in Chicago or Madison and add us on. And but we have a very – we're you know, school visits are hot and we do a lot of school outreach. And we – you know, you build up your reputation and we got – I can already say this is the most prestigious kids authors I'm going to get. It's John Klassen and Mac Barnett. They both got the Caldecott. They've been shortlisted. And
they're big names in the business.
They're big names. Yeah. And they're so fun too. They're funny and the art is beautiful. The book's called the new book's called Sam and Dave Dig a Hole. And it's about these two little boys who are hanging around their little house and decide they're going to go out and have this adventure. And they take their dog and they start digging. And they get tired and they brought chocolate milk with them. And everywhere they dig, they just miss these treasures. And they're digging all over the place and it becomes all these crazy patterns. And then finally they get tired and they try to leave and they fall through a hole. And it's just wonderful. It's not a wordless book. The text is actually terrific. Mac Barnett is – he just had a book called President Taft is Taking a Bath, and it's just great. And John Klassen, you know, This Is Not My Hat. And there's so – you can only imagine what they're going to be like with kids because those kids are just going to be overwhelmed. So we're – yeah, they're coming on October 14th. We are – I'm already panicking about this. How do I make this good? We're the launch event for the book, the very first day it's on sale, which we get to do a few times a year. But it's panicky because like when we had Louise Penny, they expect a lot more from you. They're like, you're setting the tone. You better make it good. Don't mess
so
it
I should
up.
I should expect a pitch at some point.
Yo, double pitch. And we're gonna it won't be just a talk. Like we have a public event in the store and we're already like, okay, dirt, holes, digging. What do we do? Fill the store with dirt.
We've already done Louis Sechar's Holes.
Yes, it is sort of a picture book version of Holes, isn't it? That's my pitch.
So let's talk about one more book while we still have time. And there is an author with a new book, but she may have well gotten a pretty good break at Boswell itself.
Yes, that's right. We have been huge fans of this author named Emily St. John Mandel. We hosted her for her last book. She's had three books, and two of the three have been number one Indie Next picks, which is when independent bookstores all over the country read books early, try to write reviews in it, and then our trade association tabulates it and makes a little flyer, and all the bookstores use it. And it's actually a major deal. It's a wonderful marketing program. I'm so glad that they came up with it because it's, you know, it just really puts us on the map a little more because we're, you know, independent bookstores, it's 1,000 different voices arguing with each other. And it's nice to have somebody saying, well, I know you disagree on everything, but here's some things you'd agree on. So she's always just had this amazing bookseller love. The Lola Quartet was the last book, Last Night in Montreal. But she was with a very small publisher that had trouble kind of breaking her out with the critics who are not as always amenable to small presses, the major critics, as booksellers are, to be honest. And so we were having this conversation. We had a very nice event and a weird we're doing Saturday night events periodically, which people are like, we had an author say, you're really doing this on Saturday night, Alan Weisman? I'm like, yeah, what the heck? It's it's a party. So we were chatting and we've been chatting about her book and I had this really fascinating conversation about where she needed to go. Like, she's such an amazing author. She needs to get to the next level. And then I talked about it to my sales rep, one of my Random House reps, who, you know, we were talking about this and he happened to be talking to an editor at Knopf, one of the Random House imprints, Penguin Random House imprints, I should say. And let me just, you know, one usually doesn't know that did anything, but they have something called the Editor's Buzz Panel where six breakout novels get their start at the beginning of the show with editors talking about these books. And it was a really great buzz panel this year. And this is a major thing. This is like six distinctive books and they can't be superstars. They have to be either developing authors, not necessarily first books. And lo and behold, the editor, Jenny Jackson, gave a shout out to my sales rep, Jason Gobble. And I was like, wow. And I was like, and I'm thinking about it. She said after a call, after he was in Milwaukee, I'm like, oh, that's me sort of. So the new book's called Station 11. She's written all kinds of books, but the very hot thing right now is speculative elements to a book that you don't classify as science fiction or fantasy. And so this book starts with an actor performing King Lear who dies, and a few hours later the world starts falling apart as well. But the theatrical element of the book continues throughout. So we were able to get the author to come. The book's on sale June 9th. I think she's in the store on June 22nd. But now I'm thinking, oh, I better do a really good job on that too. King Lear. Destruction.
Well, outstanding. Thanks for the backstage tour for us. And we'll see you again soon.
Looking forward to it.
Daniel Golden is the proprietor of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. He talked with Mitch Teich, and you'll find a list of the upcoming titles he mentioned at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Well, speaking of books, we're going to take one last break and then discover some places in Milwaukee that aren't immediately apparent. Bobby Tanzillo takes us on a tour of hidden Milwaukee next when Lake Effect returns. You are listening to us on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The line goes something like this. It was midnight in the city that keeps its secrets. And like in all cities, there are quite a few out-of-the-way and forgotten corners of Milwaukee. Some are hidden in plain sight. Others take a bit of sleuthing. And as Bobby Tanzillo found out, some of them require no fear of spiders, heights, or closed spaces to access. By day, Tanzillo is the managing editor of OnMilwaukee.com, but his passion may just be in exploring all the places in town you never thought you could get to. And his new book, Hidden History of Milwaukee, showcases a number of them. He joins me in the studio now. Hey, Bobby, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks, Bonnie. It's great to be here.
Hidden History of Milwaukee. This is a great book because I sat down and learned so much about Milwaukee. And one of the things I learned was that it seemed like doing this book involved you either climbing up very, very tall things or going very, very deep into the ground most of the time.
Yes, not always. You know, what I liked about doing it was that, like you reading it, I was learning about Milwaukee as I went. I mean, I sort of went to these places with no, well, I shouldn't say no preconceived notions, but I guess my preconceived notions were like everybody else. You go past this place, it's nice, it's a landmark, and you move on, keep going. And I just decided kind of spur of the moment to call this place or call that place and say, can I come see it? And there was always a story to be had, you know, when you go to these places, and often a story I had no idea existed. In some cases, like Lake Emily under Northwestern Mutual, I went because I wanted to see what could be seen of this lake or retention pond or whatever it technically was there on the site, because I knew a little bit about that story. But even when I went there, I found out all kinds of things I didn't know, like this thing they call Little Egypt, which is an old sort of grand staircase that's still there, but now it's underground. You walk in there and you go into this big open space, and here's this beautiful staircase, and there's nobody there, and it's dark.
And how far underground are you at that point?
Maybe the grade is about maybe 18 to 20 feet above your head.
So Lake Emily is underneath the Northwestern Mutual main building. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think – and a little bit behind it, but that doesn't really matter so much anymore, you know, because there had been a building, an addition put on behind it that's no longer there, although the basement is still there. The basement of that building is still there.
And they still use it.
Yes.
One of the things that, of course, I didn't even think about until I was reading the book was that when Wisconsin Avenue was actually like a tributary into the lake.
Yeah, right.
And so that Lake Emily, which whatever – whether it's a pond or whatever – existed long before we were building in Milwaukee.
Right. Yeah, it was basically a place that sort of filled up, I think, when it rained. Do you know what I mean? I think there was always water there from what I can tell, but it never seemed like it got super deep.
So it wasn't like there was water all the time, but
no,
it
but
would
people
fill
remember
up.
Like people remember, you know, you can find memoirs where people talk about having gone swimming there and things. So it was deep enough to do that at times, you know. But I'm not sure it was technically a lake. You know,
okay.
There seems to be a lot of discussion about if you go back and look at different sources about whether or not it was actually a lake or just a retention pond, sort of like a natural kind of collecting place for water.
Awfully close to Lake Michigan to be another lake.
Yeah, and if you look at – there's a painting that used to – when I worked at the Sentinel, it hung in the Sentinel newsroom. But now it's at the County Historical Society, I believe. And it's a painting that shows Wisconsin Avenue at that time. And you can see Wisconsin Avenue where the roadbed is now was sort of a gully, and water would run down and then run from there into the lake. And this was sort of right adjacent to that. So I think it was all part of that kind of natural system of runoff there.
It sounded like you had to get quite a lot of permission to get down as far down as you got to go, although not quite to the lake.
No, not quite to the lake, although I think I got as close to the lake as anybody can get. That's what they said. We went in the basement and, you know, they open these – they have these holes in the ground and they can open them and you look down, you can see a little bit of water. And if you can see water, everything's good because the water has to be there to prevent the pilings, the wooden pilings that hold the building up from rotting away. So then I thought that was as close as we can get. But then the guy who took me around said, oh, there's one more place we can go. And he opened a hatch in the floor. And he said, after you. And, you know, when somebody opens a hatch in the floor, I go in. So we went down, and that's like that's a sub-basement that you can't even – we couldn't stand up in it. We had to sort of bend maybe 3/4. And then that's as close as you can get. So there you're about 4 feet closer to it. So at that point, you're maybe 4 feet above the actual water line.
The book is full of places around Milwaukee that are like this, but let's go. Unfortunately, we're staying still on Wisconsin Avenue with this, and I want to get out of like downtown, but this is like an iconic thing, which is the gaslight.
Oh, that which was fun.
And so this is
really fun.
From going all the way down underneath, now you're all the way to the top, or
yeah.
Could you get to the top?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The hardest part about that was climbing through the spider webs to get to the
I have to say, you're braver than I.
Because they had spiders in them. You know, otherwise,
yeah.
I wouldn't really mind. In the lobby of that building, it's like walking into – almost like walking into the Empire State Building or Rockefeller Center. The lobby in there is a beautiful Art Deco lobby, which is really nice. But then you can go up to the top and you can go out onto the roof. And then you climb up the platform that the flame is on. And then the best part is you can kind of stick your head in the flame.
Can you really?
Yeah, it's just a big – I'm not sure if it's glass or – I think it was plastic – you can kind of stick your head in there and see the lights in there. So it's great that it's still there, and I know they're working on trying to get it to be lit up a little more often than it is now.
Right. You said something about LEDs, trying to change it over to LEDs.
Yeah, I think it's a budgetary
thing.
It's expensive to keep light bulbs running in there all the time.
So you've gone to the Heights,
mm-hmm.
and I know there were a few other things, like you went to the top of St. Jehoshaphat.
Yes, which was really one of the first things I did that kind of got me interested in doing this. Not long before that, I went with Molly Snyder at On Milwaukee. All of these, by the way, I wrote for onmilwaukee.com, where I'm the managing editor. And I get to do these things because I work at the place that lets me do all these things, you know. I work with Molly, and she got the opportunity to go to the top of the Allen Bradley Clock Tower. And I always wanted to go up. I heard there was like a room up there that they use as a party room, and we got to do that. But we also got to go outside all the way at the top at the base of the flagpole. And that's just exhilarating. The wind is blowing. It's a beautiful day. So when we got asked about going up to the top of St. Jehoshaphat, I said, sure, you know, let's do this. And they made me sign a waiver. And, you know, usually when I've signed waivers, I've thought, well, why did they make me sign that? You know, but here you're climbing up these wooden ladders that were built for workmen when they built the dome. And they go sort of straight up in 12 feet into darkness. You don't know where you're going. You get up there, and then there's another one. And you end up crawling across the dome on this sort of a ladder. But it's, you know, it follows the curve of the dome. So you're on all fours really going up this ladder. And you get to the top, and there's that oculus that is just open. There's nothing covering it. It goes straight down to the floor of the sanctuary of the church. So that's a little
quite a far
creepy.
Way down.
And then you can keep going up. And so when I did that one, I thought, that's the kind of place they really want you to sign a waiver, and they're smart to do that. But that – it became addictive to me then. I really just – you know, after that, I got a chance to go up to City Hall, and then I did the City Hall thing, and the Art Museum said, oh, you got to come up and come out on the wings. And so I did that, and one thing just would sort of lead to another.
As you said, these were all columns and on Milwaukee. And so how long did it take you to have all these adventures so that you could put them into a book?
I think I have been doing a maybe – about 2 years now.
Okay.
Probably about 2 years. And they just – they keep coming. There's been a bunch since the book, and every now – you know, now and then I write one and I think, oh, I wish I would have had time. I would have been able to get that done.
Have to do a second
book. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. There is one in here that I really like because it's not really about a building, and that's the rare book room.
Oh, at the library.
At the library.
Which also has the great architectural archive on the same floor. The stuff they have there is just incredible. And what's really nice about it now, though, is some of the things in the book people can't really do. They're not open to the public. But the rare books room, although it's not open for walk-ins, you can make an appointment and you can go look at anything in there. These things belong to us, you know. There are just some incredible treasures in there. And the librarians who are in charge of that collection are super passionate about it. And the most amazing thing is this book, this huge oversized book that they put together to raise money to build one of the statues that's out in the Court of Honor in front of the library there. And Captain Pabst ended up buying the book, you know, to raise money for this thing. But this book has just hundreds and hundreds of handwritten messages and signatures from all kinds of famous people of the era. There's presidents, there's musicians, John Philip Sousa, there's Mark Twain.
Oh, this is the autograph book.
This is the autograph book.
Yeah.
And it's incredible because, like, Twain wrote a few lines, a verse, and the artists would sign their name, but then they'd make a little sketch next to it. And it's really just an incredible, incredible thing.
Well, as you said, a lot of the things that you did, most of us aren't going to be able to do. You got special permission. Of the things that people can do other than the library, what would you recommend from the book?
You can take a tour of the bell tower of City Hall. People can do that. You can just go to City Hall, and I don't know if they do it on the spot or if you have to make an appointment, but that's a great thing to do because usually they'll let you ring the bell too.
Oh, cool.
Which is nice. Now, our office is now across the street from City Hall, and at random times during the day, I'll hear the bell ringing, and I'll say, somebody's getting a tour.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can do that, and that's incredible. With all due respect to the Art Museum, that's really the icon of Milwaukee architecture, I think. That's – until the Art Museum was built, that was the building everybody – thanks to Laverne and Shirley, maybe – that everybody associated with Milwaukee.
So, and it's a beautiful building.
Oh, and it's a beautiful building. And what's great about it is the first place you go when you go on that tour is you go – the first steps that go up to the top are an old apartment. A caretaker lived in that bell tower, and at least one kid was raised up there who later got a job for the city. I mentioned it in the
very film. Cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that's public?
Because
I'm assuming that people are going to read this and go, God, I want to go see that.
Well, you know, actually, a number of these things. You could go Wisconsin Club. You can go to the Wisconsin Club and eat usually, and
that's an amazing
domes.
Building, too, and certainly
yes,
the domes.
And the domes. You can, of course, see the Art Museum, but you can't go to the top. The World's Fair Pavilion that Pabst built for Chicago in 1893 is the entry to the Pabst Mansion now. So you can't go to the Pabst Mansion without going through it. So you have to. That's one you definitely can go to. Some places like, you know, some of the churches I wrote about, St. Paul's, you can go in. You know, and if they're closed, usually there's somebody there that'll let you in and look.
Well, Bobby, it has been great having you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Bonnie.
When he isn't finding hidden parts of Milwaukee to scale, climb, or dive into, Bobby Tanzillo is the managing editor of OnMilwaukee.com, and his book, Hidden History of Milwaukee, is published by the History Press. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. Stay tuned.